Welcome to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec. Now here's your host, Jason Miller.
My guest today is David Bray, the Federal Communication Commission's Chief Information Officer. A couple topics that are popping up when we talk within the federal community, and I think these are the type of things that addressed at the Executive Leadership Conference put on by ACT-IAC, is this idea of government and technology and the role of technology really changing. And we saw that with the Federal IT Acquisition Reform Act, FITARA. We're seeing it with cybersecurity, post-cyber sprint world, where IT is no longer just the IT person's responsibility, really more of a top-level management priority. Talk a little bit about your experience and how you see things changing, both within the FCC and more broadly across the government.
When I arrived at the FCC, there were 207 different systems, and trying to get out of that hole of having them all on premise, average age 10 years old, that was something that obviously as CIO I could help drive, but our success was ultimately going to be determined by how much the chairman of the FCC, the managing director of the FCC, as well as my peers, the chief financial officer, would buy into the fact that we had to get out of having legacy systems. And so a large part of what I focused on, in addition to trying to shape the narrative that we needed to move to public cloud and commercial service provider, was to get their buy-in to invest in us and to see what we could do. And in addition, it wasn't simply just moving what we were currently doing on-premise, the same exact processes, to the public cloud, but in fact, working with the bureaus and offices and using what we call our entrepreneurs on the inside, to say, well, in the past, maybe you required people to download a PDF that was one of 18 different forms. They had to fill that out by hand and mail that in. That process may have worked for the early 90s, but that's probably not what you want to be doing now in 2015, 2016. And so it was also not just thinking about how you move things with speed to a better digital platform, but then also how can you make it easier for your stakeholders so they don't have to figure out one of 18 different forms. Instead, they can answer seven questions, and much like TurboTax, they've then automatically filled out one of those forms without even knowing it, much easier, much faster, and much more responsive. So when I talk to my fellow peers in the private sector, and they use the words digital business, we sort of both smile and we agree that what part of your business would you not want to have digital? I think the same thing is true about public service, which is increasingly what we're doing here in public service, and that's government, but even more than government, needs to be more than just simply thinking about IT as an IT function. It's really about how do you bake in delivering services to the public that have IT baked in, that have privacy and security baked in. But it really is just thinking about how we redo that business, because I would submit, as increasingly we get connected as a nation, as increasingly people have access to computers, smartphones, how many of us would be willing to actually volunteer data on air quality or water quality or transportation quality or air quality if it would make our communities safer and better? I mean, that's why I also try to say the Executive Leadership Conference, in my opinion, the word federal government is an increasingly outdated term. We really need to talk about public service that includes members of the public that not only receive services, but if they want, they can actually provide data anonymously and privately that actually makes their local communities safer or more sound. You think about what happened in New York, where they actually were trying to find a suspect. By engaging the larger community, they could find that individual faster and therefore make everybody safer as a result. At the FCC, back in late 2013, we actually did a crowdsourced app that was open source. And by seeing that we weren't collecting your IP address and we didn't know who you were in a five-mile radius, people actually used that app to inform what were connection speeds across the country by provider. And actually, by getting that trust, our terms and conditions were only two pages long. It was the fourth most on an app right behind Google Chrome. And so I really hope that the dialogue for 2017 and beyond is not just about getting off legacy systems, IT modernization. I mean, I think that's a necessary part. But I really think the most important thing that we can have in 2017 and beyond is really how we redo the business of public service such that it is the public, private sector partners, and government working for the whole of the nation.
All right, so there's a lot there to follow up on. Let me step back for a second and start with this idea of working within the FCC and when you guys decided to move to the cloud and really modernize a lot. Give me a sense of what did you do to convince or to get the CFO and the commissioners of the FCC on board with this plan? Because we know FCC's had a lot of turnover in the CIO role before you. We know that there was not a lot of programs that showed a ton of success. And as you said, there's a lot on legacy systems, so they were used to doing things the way they were doing it.
And I think that hits the nail on the head, that people were used to doing things the way they did it, and what is the case for executive leadership to invest in you as the new CIO? I mean, again, I was number 10. There had been 9 CIOs in 8 years. Why should they think that I'm somehow going to be different? And so the way we made that case was, first, we assessed what was the current landscape. How bad were things? And that's when we came back with the statistics that said we're spending more than 85% of our budget just to maintain these legacy systems. The average age of these systems is more than 10 years old. We have some systems that are 18, 19, 20 years old. At the time, fortunately, we've now retired it, we did have 2 Sun E25Ks weighing 1 ton each running in the basement of the FCC. Glad to see those gone. And so first, that was the baseline. And then we made an assessment of why hadn't past efforts worked? So learn from the past efforts so that you make sure you don't repeat the same conditions going forward. And then from that, make a case as to why we think our new strategy is going to be different. And so basically what we assess with past efforts is they had either not involved the existing bureau or office stakeholders or the stakeholders on the outside. In fact, there were several cases where back in 2010, they had brought in a new team from the outside, some folks from Silicon Valley. They had called it New Media. And this New Media team was separate from the existing IT team, but the New Media team didn't interact at all with internal stakeholders or external stakeholders from the FCC when they redid the website. And that resulted in a lot of frustration because people had been used to finding things a certain way. They had been used to certain user interfaces a certain way. And you might think it's a minor change to move the search box from the left side to the right side, but if you've been using that system for 20 years, for some people, that's a massive change, and it can cause angst. And so we were very deliberate about whatever change we did, it would involve our stakeholders, it would be about making it easier for them, and it would also be about trying to get out of the trap of an ever-accelerating cost problem. That's how I got my chief financial officer to sort of partner with us, of that 85% would grow to be 90% and go to be 95%. And if that happened, we just wouldn't have any money to do anything new at all. And so ultimately, it was a business case on the inside, and it was about showing small successes to get the trust necessary for large successes. And so we had some small successes where we moved our consumer help desk that was public-facing, and we did that instead of taking 18, 24 months, we did in less than 6 months. We did it 1/6 the price. We had some other wins like that actually made them feel like, okay, so they're serious. And then that's when we got enough trust to do the big leap, which was Operation Server Lift, which was about a year and a month ago today, last Labor Day. And that really then got us going forward, because then we had nothing on premise. And even with a flat budget, because we've had a flat budget for the last 8 years, we dropped from spending 85% to being 50% to maintain systems, which gave us enough fuel, as it were, to modernize the remaining systems at that commercial provider to move to public cloud platforms.
So you're now spending 50% on legacy systems.
Yep, our O&M is actually less than 50%. It's right now about 48, 49%.
Wow. I mean, that's a huge drop, and that's what, you know, every CIO is looking at. Now, I know, David, some other CIOs are listening to this going, yeah, but he works at the FCC. What's your budget? $5? I mean, you know. But the point is, I think it can be done, and it can be done, as you outlined, the step-by-step-by-step. Do you have a idea of how small you'd like that to get down to? I mean, is 30% the right number? Is 45% the right number for O&M?
Probably between 40 and 50. We probably are as low as we can go, because at the end of the day, while I think there may have been some predecessors in the past that said that cloud is first and foremost about it being less expensive, I really think about, if you get a good public cloud platform, software as a service or platform as a service partner, really what you're getting is the economy of scale that comes with them maintaining the patches, maintaining the updates, maintaining the security. And sure, maybe if you strip all those things off and just do plain vanilla cloud, it's cheaper. But I kind of want the partner to be responsible for keeping it up to date, doing the security and everything like that. And so I think 40 to 50% is probably better. But what we really get with this, and this is the thing I really separate, is first and foremost, if you had asked us to stand up a new system or a new prototype of a system before we went to a public cloud and commercial service provider, it would have been 6 or 7 months to get you a new system. We'd have to procure it. We'd have to do the requirements and everything like that. But if you come to us with requirements now, we can have a working prototype in less than 48 hours, so 2 days. And that's because we're remixing existing commercial microservices, whether it be software as a service or platform as a service, stitching together them with a very thin API, and then having a very flexible user interface on top of it. And so the fact that I can stand up a new prototype in less than 2 days, that is the big gain. In fact, there's some cases now where we go back to our partners at the FCC and are like, wait, we weren't expecting something for another 3 or 4 weeks. We're like, well, we can wait, but just so you know, we're ready now. And then there's also the resiliency. Again, yes, our cybersecurity people will be paying attention to what's going on in these clouds, but I have no doubt that the vendors themselves will also have their cybersecurity people, and so there's an economy of scale that comes with that resiliency by working with partners in industry.
We have to take a break. My guest today is David Bray, the Federal Communication Commission's Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec. Now, here's your host, Jason Miller.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest today is David Bray, the Federal Communication Commission's Chief Information Officer. The other piece of this is, and I think you mentioned it, as you're going through the effort to make the case to your C-suite executives, you also were making the case to the external stakeholders. And this goes back to, I think, the point you made earlier regarding this idea of what does the federal government is or mean anymore, and really shouldn't public sector be broadened? That's an interesting concept that a lot of people are going to cringe at. Talk about why you think this could work versus all the reasons why it can't work.
I first would put forward, and again, this may be a little bit provocative, however, we intend to talk about it at Executive Leadership Conference. I think there are those individuals in the world outside the United States that are watching us to see whether or not representative democracies, the business of a republic, can continue to work 10 to 15 years from now. And I would submit a couple things have happened. One, the internet, while it's made us more transparent, also make it easier for, unfortunately, disinformation to happen. The countries, the Middle Eastern countries involved with the Arab Awakening, since the Arab Awakening, according to the World Bank, all except for Tunisia are now actually worse off in terms of economics and social conditions. And in fact, Tunisia in the last 3 years has been declining too. So it's worth thinking about whether or not, had the Berlin Wall fallen not in 1989 but fallen in 2009, would it have been peaceful a transition, or would have people been able to use the internet and said, you know, this is just a great conspiracy, there is no such thing as actually representative democracy being a republic, and it wouldn't have been that peaceful, and it would have created echo chambers. And so I celebrate the internet's made us more transparent, but I think we have to have a hard look about what does it mean in an era in which anybody can say anything and there really are no brokers that say, well, that's not exactly correct or that's not exactly right, and there's really no way to actually sort of handle the business of trying to actually be a social order. So I think that's one thing that's being watched. The second thing is we're trying to do things both at speed and at scale, and the world is changing exponentially. When I started the FCC in 2013, there were 7 billion network devices on the face of the planet for 7 billion human beings. 2 years later, in 2015, so just last year, we've gone up to 14 billion network devices on the face of the planet. And that's going to continue to double, such that in less than 4 years, we're going to see 50 billion on up. Data's doubling every 2 years, too. And so if we try to do the business of running the nation solely by government professionals, I don't think we're going to be able to keep up with that exponential speed. And so the question is, well, what takes its place? And the thing I would submit is, well, people care about their local environments. They want them to be safer. They want them to be cleaner. They want them to have energy and transportation efficiency. And so, again, I mean, if in your pocket, if you have a smartphone, you have what was apparently more computing power, according to some, than President Reagan had available in 1981 in your pocket. And would you be willing, if you had trust that it was going to be used appropriately, to anonymously share data on air quality or water quality if you opted in? You don't have to if you don't want to. You can turn it off if you want to. And I think the proof point we had at the FCC was when we did the FCC speed test app. You know, we had been paying for volunteers to monitor their broadband connections, both mobile as well as at home, kind of like the Nielsen ratings back in late 2013. But we thought about, well, why don't we crowdsource this? And that way we could save some money. And by crowdsourcing it, and by having it so that you could take a look at the code, and we put it on GitHub, enough groups came out and said, yeah, they're actually doing what they said. They baked in privacy and security by design. They're not tracking your IP address. They don't know who you are in a five-mile radius. And again, this was late 2013, where you could probably imagine me saying, hi, I'm with the U.S. government. Would you like to download an app that will monitor your connection speed? in other cases, might not have been well accepted. But by making transparent what the algorithm was doing, enough people were willing to do it. And I think, for me, that's just tip of the iceberg. If we could ensure that our sporting events were safer because we knew what the algorithm was doing, if we could ensure that we had better air quality or water quality, that's a conversation I think needs to happen with the public. And again, you see the same thing happening in Silicon Valley and Austin, Texas, and Boston, Massachusetts, where firms are specializing at doing what they do best. I've talked to CIOs at several different tech companies, and they said, aside from the secret sauce that serves our tech company, you know, our HR system is a cloud platform that we didn't write. Google, after spending about 2 or 3 years, eventually went with a third-party HR system outside of Google, not because they couldn't find any good programmers, I'm sure, but just because they realized it's play to your strengths. And so I would submit, for a lot of what we do as government professionals, our strength is not writing code. It's about serving the mission. And so how can we work with the public? How can we work with the private sector to bring those tools to accomplish the mission?
Fascinating concept, a fascinating idea, and I think one key piece to this is the role you are in now as the CIO, and somebody who has to come in and really have a different viewpoint from a CIO's chair, not the person who, as you said, writes the code, runs the systems, but understands the business and how technology can aid the business. So I think a good point now is to move on to the changing role of the CIO. You have some thoughts about that in terms of where the CIO maybe needs to go in the next, you know, 6 months, a year, 5 years?
We have so many different vectors hitting us all at once. You've got the Internet of Things becoming the Internet of Everything. As I mentioned, we've already passed 14 billion network devices on the face of the planet, 15 billion within the next 4 years or less. That, to me, if a CIO is really thinking about accomplishing the mission, accomplishing the business of the organization, as opposed to what I would say 1990 CIOs were, which was about running infrastructure. If you cast that aside and say, look, that's just table stakes, you've got to make sure that gets done, but really what you're trying to do is think about the business or the mission. How can all these devices that are present inform the organization, make it more adaptable, make it more agile? How can it make it so that the organization is able to respond to opportunities as well as address threats faster and serve their stakeholders, whether the stakeholders be citizens, whether the stakeholders be customers, whether they be business to business. You know, I celebrate that more and more of focus is being put on making sure that what we do in public service serves citizens, and I think that's great. But we also need to recognize that a lot of what public service does serves nonprofit groups, serves other local or state governments, serves industry, that we also need to work on those bridges as well, because if we don't improve those, according to like the GAO report, that's at least two-thirds of what public service is. If it's B2C, yes, it's also B2B in some cases. And so there's first the Internet of Things. The other thing is artificial intelligence and machine learning. You think about how far we've come. 2013, there was a competition to see if anyone could write an algorithm that would grade papers as good as a third-grade teacher, and for $60,000, someone did that. Then there's a copier that can actually grade handwritten tests and handwritten answers for the teacher with no prior programming. It's still expensive, more expensive than a teacher, but that shows what's possible. 2015, a hedge fund elects to its board of directors an algorithm and gives it voting rights. In 2016, I've actually heard there's a competition to answer real estate law questions with AI as good as real estate lawyers. And right now it's coming in at about 75-80% accuracy. And so a lot of what we do in public service is rote and repetitive because we want it to be fair. And so it has to follow a very prescribed rule-based process. And it also involves usually 3 or 4 or 5 different people because you want to minimize the bias. The more people that look at it, it's harder for any one person to be too untoward or too powerful in where it goes. But if you think about it, if you make that algorithm open source, one, it's very easy to follow a rule-based process, which a lot of public service is. And two, instead of waiting for 3 or 4 or 5 different people to review it and finally give the stamp of approval, the machine can come back in 2 or 3 seconds. And by making, the algorithm open source, people would take a look at it and say, okay, I can see where this works, or maybe it is biased, here's how you improve it, and the public could give comments and make it better. So that's another thing. And then finally, the other intersection is because the Internet is increasingly becoming ubiquitous, we still have to solve the digital divide. We're not at Internet adoption across the entire nation, let alone the entire world. We're at about less than 50% for the entire world, and I think we also have a lot of ways to go with the United States. But as that happens, again, where you work, when you work, that is very flexible. And I think an adapt CIO will really be helping their executive leadership, their CEO, as well as other C-suite leaders recognize we can transform how we do the mission, the business of this organization, given these trends of we now can be more responsive based on sensors coming in from the IoT, we can use AI to make things faster, and again, towards the focus on agility and responsibility moving forward on the organization. And finally, where we work and who we work with, that increasingly is going to become sort of flexible and 24/7. So that's why I really think if we really want to make sure we can show the rest of the world that representative democracy can continue to exist, we've got to have these conversations now. And we've got to get more change agents beyond just CIOs thinking about how do we reinvent doing the business of the nation.
We have to take a break. My guest today is David Bray, the Federal Communication Commission's Chief Information Officer. I'm your host, Jason Miller, and you're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com at 1500 AM.
You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec. Now here's your host, Jason Miller.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. My guest today is David Bray, the Federal Communication Commission's Chief Information Officer. You use that term quite often, more change agents, and I think it's an interesting term in the sense of change agent isn't someone who knows how to code or can write a program. It's a person who understands how to make change that betters whatever you're trying to better, whether it's a better cloud computing system or a better response to a constituent. Give me a sense of how the FCC has taken advantage of those change agents. You called them entrepreneurs earlier in the conversation as well.
First, I would define a change agent as anyone who is willing to step outside of the status quo and illuminate the way forward beyond the status quo. And so with that very definition, like you said, anybody can be a change agent. You don't have to have any specialized expertise other than being willing to step beyond the status quo and, in particular, manage the friction associated with that. I'm sure you've seen it, I've seen it, where there are people that want change, but they don't think about their strategy for how they're going to manage the friction that change is going to create, and any change will. And then they're surprised when all they do is create a whole lot of heat and light, but it doesn't move the car forward or do anything. And so with the entrepreneurs we have at the FCC, I think at least one-third, if not half, of the new entrepreneurs I hired actually came from the bureaus and offices and were not necessarily IT-specific professional. They were not categorized as that series when I hired them. And that's because they knew the mission, the edge of whatever bureau they were working with. And they also were very good listeners. That's the other thing that makes for a very good change agent, is if you're going to create change, before you put forward your own ideas, take the time to understand the landscape, take the time to listen, synthesize the different narratives of things that came past as well as in the present, and then figure out, like almost like a good startup. If you're going to disrupt the marketplace, have done your market research and figure out what's the best way to positively disrupt it in a way that will thrive and that people will see the value. Because initially, when you come forward with your idea as a change agent, someone's going to say, get back in your box. I think for the last 20 years, I've always been told, get back in my box. And I'm like, I like being outside of my box. Same thing with these change agents is if I'm going to invest in them, we'll sit down, we'll talk about why you should do this. We'll also talk about, I actually will ask them, give me three reasons why you shouldn't. And then once you give me those three reasons, how are we going to mitigate the friction why you shouldn't do that? And then I say, okay, run as quickly as you can. Show what you can do in 60 days, 120 days. I will be your flak jacket. So if the bureau gets upset, we'll talk, we'll figure out how to make it happen, or if the stakeholder on the outside happens. And at the end of the day, the way that you really create long-term cultural change in any organization, in my opinion, is by the results that you deliver. So you're not focusing on changing the culture. You're focusing on delivering results differently and better. And by delivering results differently and better over time, you end up changing the culture, but that's actually almost like a side effect of just delivering better results.
Give me one or two examples of maybe a non-IT change agent, but you know, had an IT component, obviously, if it's working out of your office.
One would be we had a very decentralized and sometimes disconnected HR processes. In fact, I think when I started at the FCC, I think it took them about 6 months before they realized they hadn't added me to the executive leader's email distribution list, which was kind of embarrassing. And so we said, well, what can we do to improve the onboarding process, and what can we do to improve the offboarding process? And in a lot of respects, that, none of that was something with IT. I mean, other than IT would provide the email or something like that. But the change agent and the entrepreneur involved with that took the time to listen to the different people that were involved in, okay, well, we've hired this person. Now we've got involved with getting there, make sure they get their security clearance, make sure they've got a desk to sit at, make sure they get some equipment and everything like that. And they mapped out the different processes, and they figured out a way to streamline it so that instead of you having to talk to 25 or 30 different people if someone was starting or ending at the FCC, it was a much faster workflow. And that was changing things because people actually felt a little bit threatened that, well, wait, my job was to specifically do this. If you streamline it, what's my job now? And am I going to still have a job? And so they had to work that narrative, and they had to say, look, even if you're no longer doing this time-consuming activity, you're going to have more time to do other things, and guess what? There's no shortage of things to be done to help the organization along. So that was one example. Another example, we've been doing auctions for a very long time at the FCC with Spectrum. And while a lot of the Spectrum involve, the auctions involve IT, also a lot of them involve processes that are just not IT-related. And so we've had a very good entrepreneur by the name of Jill Goldberger who has taken the time. She's dived into mapping how FCC has done auctions. It's, for me, it's probably one of the most comprehensive pictures of how the entire life cycle works. And that involved, I'd say, at least 75% of her job was talking to non-IT stakeholders and actually identifying what could be possible improvements. And so while at the end of the day, IT will be a part of it, this is why I try to say there are no IT projects. There are business projects, there are mission projects that have IT baked into it, because I would say at least 75% of the work that she did to make sure that we continue to do auctions well, and in some respects even streamline them and make them more efficient, were non-IT process improvements as opposed to specifically doing anything technology-related.
All right, David, so people are going to listen to this and they're going to go, David Bray, again, he's so positive. He thinks the world, you know, is this shiny, happy place. What do you say to the people who think that you live in with unicorns and lucky charms and you know there's magic at the end of the rainbow? And how do you kind of convince people that this is possible and this is, must be done, not just needs to be done?
I love the happy rainbow comment. So, I mean, I started off way back when with the Bioterrorism Preparedness Response Program at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, which when I started in 2000, you can imagine going to parties and people say, what do you do? And you say, I do bioterrorism preparedness, and that pretty much was a mood killer, and people say, okay, next. So, you know, I recognize that the world is dark. I recognize that human beings don't always do great things. I recognize humans do a lot of mediocre things. In fact, I think our founders did when they said, what is government but the greatest reflection of humanity? If all men and women were angels, no government would be necessary. I mean, it is the greatest reflection of what we do, which means it does some good things and does some awful things and does some mediocre things. If I wanted to be controversial and provocative, it's worth thinking about how there are private sector companies where some of their execs have some pretty significant controversies. I won't name the specific company, but there was one company where their head of advanced R&D overdosed on heroin in the presence of a prostitute and died. But you don't really hear about that because, one, they are very good about making sure it doesn't hit the news. And, two, I celebrate the fact that, yes, in our system, if something goes wrong, it does see the light of day. Maybe it gets overplayed, and maybe that person gets hung out to dry. But that's how we make sure that we try to avoid corruption as much as we can. I mean, that's what I think what the founders wanted when they said ambition should counter ambition. So given all that, and given that, yes, the world is not great, and sometimes humans do awful things, I think if you don't choose to see the world as possible and positive, even if you are coming from a background that is informed by experience and possibly scarred by experience, then don't be surprised if nothing ever changes. And so I choose to be positive only because the alternative is much worse, which is just give up and surrender, in which case find another job. And not only is this possible because we've shown it at the FCC, I mean, when I first arrived, I probably had less than 15% of my own employees supporting the idea of change. And then we did a checkpoint about a year ago, it was about 85%, and one person said it was like Thanksgiving. And I said, well, tell me more when they said it was like Thanksgiving. They said, well, you're all gathered around, you're hopeful, and you're positive. You recognize that you've had a long journey. It's still your dysfunctional family by no stretch of the imagination, but everyone's on their best behavior, and they're hopeful about what can be done. And I think if you can get any organization, private sector or public sector, to that point, to embrace the art of the possible, then you can make the change. again, I'm saying that we need to actually rethink how we do public service, not just out of positivity. I'm doing it because if we don't rethink how we do public service 10 or 15 years from now, coming from my national security background, I'd be worried that we showed the rest of the world representative democracy fails. And then what takes its place might be a dictatorship, an oligarchy, or something even else that is not as embracing of freedoms, tolerance, what's embodied in the First Amendment in terms of freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of the symbol. And so I think we have to elevate this conversation so it's not just a back corner IT discussion. It really is a whole of nation conversation about how do we keep up with an exponentially changing world? Because if we don't, we may find that our way of life and the things that we value in terms of freedom might be gone.
David Bray is the Federal Communications Commission's Chief Information Officer. Thank you so much. This was a fascinating conversation on so many levels and really thought-provoking. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Jason.
We have to take a break. When we come back, I shift gears a little bit and play an excerpt of a panel discussion I moderated recently on agile development or DevOps. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM.
You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. You are listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec. Now here's your host, Jason Miller.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ask the CIO on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. I'm your host, Jason Miller. Now we shift gears to talk about DevOps. I moderated a recent panel discussion at the DevOps Summit, sponsored by the Advanced Technology Academic Research Center. The panelists included Jim Tennyson, Chief Technology Officer for the Food Safety and Inspection Service at the Agriculture Department, Pam Isom, the Director of Applications Engineering and Development at the Patent and Trademark Office in the Commerce Department, and Joe Krobak, a software engineer at the U.S. Digital Service in the White House. FSIS's Tennyson leads off the discussion on agile development.
We have a lot going on, doing an entire IT modernization effort. There are lots of buzzwords in there. You've heard them all. I'm sure you've heard lots of them today. You've heard lots of them in the news and lots of people talking about them for quite some time with Agile, DevOps, Cloud, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You name it, that's kind of the direction that we're going. As well as something that's pretty cool that is new is that we're introducing and releasing VR technology that we're already currently piloting and using to use for recruitment and training efforts within the organization itself. So we've already started, we've developed some solutions that we are launching and to change our education efforts within the organization itself. Also, I'll go two more things. We're doing creating kind of a centralized interdepartmental whole genome sequencing solution in order to better come up with answers across multiple departments, talking, you know, CDC, FDA, FSIS, et cetera, et cetera. And my absolute favorite is trying to work on stomping out the bureaucracy.
Virtual reality is what you're talking about. How are you using that? Can you talk a little bit more?
Well, working with both in the virtual reality as well as augmented reality, depends on which way you want to talk about it and how you want to utilize what terms and what does what. But, yes, so retention can be difficult based on what the job is and what areas that you're doing. So if it's an inspector at a slaughterhouse or in a plant or something along those lines, you may not know exactly what you're getting yourself into when you are initially applying and trying to get yourself into this position. And being as though we have many, 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 many thousands of locations across the country, as well as you start expanding globally, we have lots of employees, and then the attrition rate could be, you know, in interesting levels. So in order to better help acclimate people ahead of time, record it as well as with the training efforts, using the VR technology, we've used 360-degree recordings of inside of areas in order to review them so that people can see how things actually operate, as well as using the augmented portion in order to review the training aspects so that he may be looking at one thing, I can see the same thing, and we can use it to better train each other on how we understand what we need to be looking for while we're working within the agency.
And from your perspective as the Chief Technology Officer, are you taking a DevOps or some kind of software development approach to do this?
Yes, because the build-out of the additional tools that are used with this requires, you know, some certain development efforts, which we are going down in the Agile DevOps manner, as well as the transition from our wonderful, I didn't even know people still used Waterfall, but there were people that used Waterfall there, and so we're making a complete transition and change and leaving the Waterfall arena completely behind and moving over to an Agile DevOps organization.
All right, very nice. We'll move next to Jim is Joe Krobak from the U.S. Digital Service. Joe?
So I'm currently working on a project at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, the Quality Payment Program, which is implementing MACRA, the Medicare and CHIP Reauthorization Act. I've been at USDS for about a year and have worked on this project since earlier this calendar year. So CMS has been adopting Agile, and we're developing software for this project with all the modern best practices. I thought I would share kind of three major learnings as someone who is kind of new to the federal government, coming and looking at things from the inside here, and some of the things that we've found successful. So I'd say number one, there's this saying that a lot of startups use, a prototype is worth 1,000 meetings. So we're doing agile development, and this really enables the use of prototypes. So we do it not just for our kind of front-end integrations or front-end websites types of things, but also for our DevOps. So let's say you want to try out a new continuous integration process. You can do a prototype of that and time box it to a two-week sprint. So we're trying to kind of meld all these different best practices. That's become very powerful to the point where leadership is now asking for demos instead of PowerPoint decks, which is, again, something that I'm kind of used to from industry, but I'm told is relatively new inside the federal government. Relatedly, we've kind of found that you get out of Agile what you put into it. So myself and other folks from CMS on what we call our product team are heavily involved in the Agile development, working with the development teams daily. In fact, we had sprint planning yesterday, which was, you know, half the day. And our leadership attends things like our sprint demos so that everyone can kind of see that leadership is bought into Agile and bought into the project that we're working on. And lastly, I just want to acknowledge, since we're talking about Agile at a DevOps summit, that all of these modern dev practices kind of go hand in hand. So we've kind of, I've noticed projects tend to go all in on these types of things. So it's not just Agile, it's not just DevOps. We have automated testing, you know, linters, unit test integration. We're trying to automate everything we can, continuous deployments, code reviews, and in terms of DevOps, we're trying to adopt all of these practices for DevOps too. So the configuration is code, and the configuration is reviewed using a pull request, just like a new feature to the website would.
All right, a couple of quick follow-ups, Joe. When we were talking before the panel, I said to Joe, I said, well, CMS uses a lot of internal feds to do the development. He actually corrected me and said, no, actually, there's a lot of contractors. Does that add another layer of complexity? Because you have the people, the culture change inside CMS, the people, and then you have the contractors as well that were hired maybe to do something specific. How have these best practices, if you will, kind of you melded between the two different communities?
You have to put a lot into it. It's tough. Tough at first. The saying we were kind of saying, you know, the first couple of months were going to be hard, and then we were going to take off like a rocket as everyone kind of got on the same page and understood that, you know, when we say unit tests, automated unit tests, we really mean automated unit tests. And that took a little while, and I think everyone has bought in, but you had to put some time and effort into that.
I really enjoy the prototype is worth 1,000 meetings. Talk about that change. How have you gotten past that idea of you need a meeting for everything?
Let's be realistic. There's still lots of meetings.
All right. But even if you could reduce by 10%, I mean, who here wouldn't want 10% less meetings?
Yes, I mean, there's tons of tools you can use. So we do user experience research, user experience design, and have rapid prototyping tools, and are able to, you know, maybe one sprint put together a wireframe and show that. And if it looks good, then the next sprint, the development team can actually implement it.
Good. All right, let's move to Pam from the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.
One of the things that I find interesting about what I do is, you know, I have a team of people that work for me that are very, very opinionated. So I think that my challenge has been to help us to see the value in each other so that we can drive and make DevOps successful. I influence not just my direct team, but I influence John Owens, our CIO, his team. So that's one of the techniques that I've had to implore in order for the development teams to be successful. So I would say that one of the things that I would like to see and that I'm really pushing is the collaboration between development and operations, but more so the enablers that support the development and operations teams. So for instance, HR, the Office of Procurement, the Program Management Offices, all of those organizations and offices support the DevOps enablement. So we oftentimes think of DevOps as just the development and operations teams, and there's a lot more to it than that. It's about all of that coming together to drive true solution delivery. So that's kind of me and what my focus is on. I'd like to talk about a couple of things that have worked well in DevOps and Agile. We focus on 2 to 3 week sprints. Our team seemed to like 3 week sprints better than two, but the manager, like me, I like the 2 week sprints so I can quickly tell what's going on and how we're doing. So that, I think that's interesting, but I give the teams what they want. If 3 weeks is better for the team, that's what we leverage. And then we seem to value the IP sprints, the innovation and planning sprints, and the HIP sprints. So by me talking, we practice scaled Agile, as opposed to just Agile itself, but the scaled Agile. And then I'm very focused on keeping sharp. So I need to stay sharp. The vendors that we work with, they bring talents and skills and abilities to the table. My team is very focused on learning from them, not just having them come in and provide solutions for us, but we actually are learning as we go. So I have launched a personal campaign with my team to keep sharp.
That's all the time we have for today. You just heard an excerpt of a panel discussion I moderated on agile development at the recent DevOps Summit, sponsored by the Advanced Technology Academic Research Center. The panelists included Jim Tunnison, the Chief Technology Officer at the Food Safety and Inspection Service within the Agriculture Department, Pam Isom, the Director of Applications, Engineering and Development at the Patent and Trademark Office in the Commerce Department, and Joe Korobek, a software engineer at the U.S. Digital Service in the White House. I'm Jason Miller, and tune in next week for another edition of Ask the CIO.
Thank you for listening to Ask the CIO, sponsored by Symantec on federalnewsradio.com and 1500.